Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your two hosts for today, Greta Anderson, together with Kay Puddock. Hello, Kay.
Hello, Greta, and hello to you, the listener.
Later in the show, we welcome Ames Parks and Rec Director Keith Abraham to hear the latest word on plans for the new indoor pool, or pools. The existing municipal pool at the high school is reaching the end of its life, and the city and school district, which currently share that pool, are at a crossroads about what to do next.
For the rest of the hour, we cover topics related to nature and the enjoyment of it. I recently recorded interviews with writer Mark Edwards, a retired trail manager at the Department of Natural Resources, and also Laura Miller, a resident of Maxwell, who spends her free time training gun dogs. Laura recently won a national gun dog championship, and she'll tell us some of what's involved in that.
But let's begin with Pat Schlarbaum, delivering us a phenology about the peregrine falcon.
Phenology is the recording of important events in nature when they are happening. And peregrine falcons will be hatching young soon. Whether referred to as the great-footed hawk, a long wing, a duck hawk, a rock hawk, or a blue meanie, the peregrine falcon occupies a unique position in our psyche of bird lore. Since medieval times, falconers have accompanied peregrines on hunting forays. The species was extirpated or lost as a breeding bird from the eastern United States by 1965. It is widely believed the last nesting pair was at Capillai Bluff, downstream from Lansing, Iowa. Early 20th century newspaper accounts tell of town folks walking down the railroad tracks by the river for spring equinox to celebrate the return of their falcons to the cliffs. In 1962, scientist and author of Silent Spring, Rachel Carson, sounded an alarm foretelling bird extinctions from ravaging biocides of the post-World War II era, particularly DDT. Although the chemical industry demeaned and criticized Carson's research, a basic law of nature was becoming obvious. Whatever affects wildlife ultimately affects humans. The Endangered Species Act was implemented in 1972, and DDT was banned in the United States. However, it was too late for peregrines that no longer nested east of the Missouri River. These top-of-the-food-chain raptors were wiped out in the wild. Beginning in 1989 in Iowa, the peregrine presence has improved, and it's a big year for peregrine falcons on the Mississippi River. There are additional nesting pairs being reported at Dubuque, Bellevue, Clinton, Muscatine, and Keokuk. This year, nesting pairs have grown from 15 last year to 20 so far this spring. Having five additional pairs show up in 1 year hasn't ever happened before. Getting these birds on the river was really the key to bringing them back. The new falcon pairs have set up nests on the Dubuque Courthouse, on a huge rock near Bellevue State Park, on a large building at ADM by the river in Clinton, on a smokestack box at the Muscatine Light and Power, and at the Energy Plant Dam in Keokuk. The Clinton site is increasingly exciting as Clinton County is the southern extent of their historic nesting range on the Mississippi River. With the inclusion of the new pair, Clinton has three nesting pairs. Predictably, there will be a lot of falcons flying over this stretch of the Mississippi River in early summer. Young falcons hone their flight skills, engaging in mock combat flights that provide incredible visual high-speed chases and maneuvers. And peregrines attract non-breeding peregrines, so it will be quite a show. Iowa's first nesting pairs in 1993 occurred at Des Moines and Cedar Rapids. The Cedar Rapids pair on their U.S. Bank building will begin hatching soon. And in Des Moines, pairs will be hatching young on the east side of the state capitol and downtown at the American Enterprise building, where they have been since 1993. There is a 2014 female falcon from downtown Des Moines at a cliff site at Wyalusing State Park in Wisconsin, just across the river from Pikes Peak State Park here in Iowa. This is the first instance of a building falcon crossing over to a natural cliff. The male is a solid cliff nesting bird that attracted the city bird to his eyrie or nest site. Elsewhere, falcons are hatching at the Mid-American Energy headquarters in Davenport, and there is a webcam that you can enjoy watching these birds by Googling WQAD Falcons, F-A-L-C-O-N-S. So let me try to describe a stoop or a dive of a peregrine falcon. As a speck in the sky at 2,000 feet, a peregrine falcon rolls over, folding its long wings. The speck becomes a bionic missile with anatomical attributes to do what it does and how it does it very well. See-through nictitating membranes arise from the lower eyelids to protect its eyes from dust or wind-blown seeds. Cartilaginous baffles in its nasal cavities ensure the back of the skull is not blown out from its velocity. The falcon's descent exceeds 270 miles per hour during the dive or stoop. Falconers have colorful descriptive terms when it comes to their raptors or birds of prey that includes hawks, owls, eagles, kites, and vultures. When diving at prey straight ahead, from great distance at great speed, a peregrine has a conflict between vision and aerodynamics. With eyes on each side of its head, it must turn its head approximately 40 degrees to see the prey. Doing this, maximum visual acuity at the deep fovea of one eye is achieved. However, the head in this position increases aerodynamic drag and slows the falcon down. The falcon could resolve this conflict by holding its head straight and flying along a logarithmic spiral path that keeps the line of sight of the deep fovea pointed sideways at the prey, and a wild peregrine observed with spotting scope and tracking device indeed approached prey the size of a pigeon from distances of up to 4,500 feet by holding its head straight and descending along a curved path that resembles the logarithmic spiral. As the diving falcon approaches its prey, its talons are clenched into a knuckle. The prey is dispatched into a poof of feathers with a knuckle to its noggin. In the case of larger birds like a duck, the prey is stunned, then grabbed and ridden to the shore. The falcon's beak is specifically notched to separate the vertebrae of its quarry in a most efficient manner. The ensuing feeding frenzy is unlike any spectacle of spearing flesh, tendons, and muscle with feathers flying in a spray of mortal being than anyone could ever imagine. It certainly sustains the peregrine's vitality until the next spectacle unfolds.
That was Pat Schlaubaum with a fascinating description of the hunting prowess of the peregrine falcon. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio.
As Pat told us earlier in the segment, the peregrine falcons are now hatching, and with the care of wildlife specialists such as Pat, their numbers in the state are growing. But falcons are not the only species that has developed elaborate procedures for hunting birds on the wing.
Yes, we agriculturalists of central Iowa are not without our hunters, and in the small town of Maxwell, there's a woman whose gun dog recently won an award in a national competition.
Laura Miller, in fact, contributes to the agricultural livelihood of our region with her research on pigs at the USDA National Animal Disease Lab. But that's just her day job. At home, she works with hunting dogs. And, Kay, you visited her recently.
Yes, Laura hunts with dogs on foot and on horseback. She also breeds gun dogs in a small way. Let's hear that recording of the interview I had with her.
I've been in Iowa at the National Animal Disease Center for almost 8 years, and I was in Nebraska before that. And in fact, that's how I got into the dogs, is I was in Nebraska for 6.5 years. And I thought, what can I do living in the middle of nowhere, Nebraska, and sort of relate to the other scientists that were there? And I thought, I need a dog. And I need a working dog, and I wanted a hunting dog. Mm-hmm. I had seen Vishlas in Scotland. We own hunting land back in Scotland, mostly hunted with pointers and setters there. But I had seen a Vishla and I realised that's the dog I wanted, and I got my first dog, Stella. She's now 12 years old, retired from field trialling, but she still hunts with me. And I got her, and she got me into this game of field trialling.
I'm not sure how many of our listeners are familiar with Vishlas. Could you sort of tell us about this kind of dog a bit?
Yes, Vishlas are a Hungarian pointer. They're a very old breed that belong to aristocrats in Hungary. And they're a versatile breed in that they can hunt fur and feather and they're very good companions in the house. They gained popularity in the US in the early 60s, and they've been in the AKC, American Kennel Club, a breed for 50 years. We just celebrated their 50-year anniversary. They are very affectionate dogs. They have lovely personalities, but they have a lot of drive, and they're called high-energy dogs. And they like to be busy. They like to have a job to do.
And as I mentioned, you've just won a Vizsla Gun Dog competition. Would you like to tell us about that and what it involves?
Yes, this was the National Walking Championship. It was held in Mingo Sportsman's Club in Ohio. There were 44 dogs started. There were 47 entries. 44 dogs competed. This is one of the biggest championships they've had for Vizslas. So I drove out 12 hours out to Ohio with Bull. He's my number one dog. He's 7 years old, and he's won a couple of national championships for me before. And we went out there, and what happens in a field trial is you are braced with another dog. So you just take off in pairs. There's handlers, and then there's judges following behind. And there's two judges, and they judge kind of on stamina, gait, style, and manners on birds. And when the dog encounters a bird or the scent, they go on point, and they must hold steady through the flush of game by the handler, and we fire a blank gun and simulate the shot. Or in this case, at this championship, they did have gunners with us, and they shoot the bird, and then the dog must complete a retrieve.
Retrieve it.
So in this championship, it was an hour walking, and those grounds in Ohio are all uphill. It was a tough walk.
Mm-hmm. And the judges have to keep up with
you. The judges keep up. They're on horseback.
Oh, okay.
And then you have your gunners on horseback. You have your gallery. So you have about 100 spectators behind you on horseback.
Wow.
At some of these events. And you also have a scout who works as part of your team. I had a good scout, Andrew Campbell, who is from New York and originally from Scotland, actually from Orkney, so that I met through this game. And so he came out and scouted for me and kept an eye out for Bull. He can't go in front of the judges, but he looks in case I lose Bull to either side.
Because the dog might...
The dog might get hung up on a bird to the side that I can't see as I'm walking uphill, and the hill drops off to the side, or it's in thick cover in the timber. And so he may go on point, and I might walk straight past him.
But the dog doesn't go after the bird or anything. He just retrieves it and points.
Yes, he must not chase. You will be eliminated from the competition
okay.
if he chases. Ideally, they will not move at all. It is permitted to turn to mark, which is to mark where the bird falls so it can make the retrieve.
Probably most people know what pointing is, but it's possible they don't. So could you explain what it is when a dog points?
When a dog goes on point, you can tell it's scented the bird. It's in the cone, the scent cone, and it just sort of goes intense. Their eyes are intense. They're focused on where they think the bird is.
And the bird is still in hiding.
In hiding.
Yes.
They can be running around. We did have one find on that where it was running either side of the bush as I tried to flush, and poor Bull had to stand there steady and not move mm-hmm. a muscle. And that intensity is very important. My dog, I can read him. I can see his line of sight. His tail set sort of tells me the bird and it's whether it's moving or not. His body is rigid. And you should be able to read your dog, and they should hold that through the flush and shot. You don't want them to let down.
When you flush the dog, you fire sometimes a blank, but you fire the gun to flush the bird out.
Yes. And actually, that's almost a reward to the dog because it's used to hunting. It's used to the gunfire, meaning, hey, we got the bird, and you can go retrieve. So they like that gunfire.
Oh. Do you ever get a dog that's scared of gunfire?
And yes, that does occur, especially if someone started their puppy too soon or introduced it to gunfire the wrong way, as in just gone and taken it hunting with a lot of people firing and it's not ready. You have to introduce them to that sound in a steady pace, mm-hmm. either starting far away with a young puppy and work up to the gunfire. And usually, actually, if they're on birds or they're chasing birds as a puppy, then they're focused on something else and they don't mind the gunfire.
Now, you talked about reading your dog. With each dog, is it a little different? You have to learn each individual dog how to read it?
Yes, or if you've brought them up and handled them the same way, they kind of bond with you and work with you. And I think that's one of the qualities Bull and I have, is that we have a strong bond. A lot of people say to me when they watch me handle, he's looking for me, he's checking, he looks back, and I sing to him as I run him, I mm-hmm. sing, and I just make a slight intonation in my song, and he knows turn this way, turn that way.
Wow.
And it's quite beautiful to watch when it's working.
Yes. Yeah. Now, pointers, when they point, the dogs that are called pointers, they usually have one paw up.
Yeah, Vizslas do that too, but that's at the beginning. Ideally, it depends on the situation of where they've caught scent. You want all 4 feet flat on the ground because if they have one leg up, they're liable to take a step forward.
Oh, okay.
And it does look nice, but the disadvantage is they're going to have to put that foot down.
Right.
And when it's that close in a competition, you don't want that happening.
Okay, okay. So you mentioned this was a walking version of the championship. So there's
yes.
a version that is not walking.
Yes, I do the horseback championships as well. When you're on horseback, it's the same idea, and the dog is working to the range of the terrain. So depending where you are, they will work bigger because they can see you. So out in Utah, they can work out to 2 miles away from you on the horse,
oh, okay.
and they still are cueing off you on the horse. So as you turn your horse or the horse's head, they know that's the direction to go in. So they learn to cue off that. When the dog goes on point, in this case, you go up, ride up, dismount your horse, go out in front and flush the bird and fire your blank gun. And then your scout will cast off the dog and you get back on your horse and continue on.
In this case that you've just described, you fired a blank, the bird flushed, but it never got shot, right?
Yes.
Isn't the dog disappointed?
Yes, and the dog can get into trouble there because he'll say, I'm just going to help you out and go chase that bird down. Or as you cast them off, go back to where that bird was.
Yeah. So casting off means they're meant to go and look for another bird.
They're meant to continue on. You continue okay. hunting. And so, in fact, we're adding more birds out into the countryside because these are often farmed birds we're so releasing.
These birds are ones that have been raised then are released after this hunt.
Pen-raised and planted out by bird planters.
Now, when I talked about this to a friend of mine, she expressed disbelief because she said the birds would be scared by the horses. So what do you say to that?
No, birds tend to sit pretty tight. They tend to hold tighter, hoping that you're going to go past them.
And the horses will be quite a long way behind the dogs, too,
yes,
I imagine.
Yeah, and you're not at a gallop. These are done at a flat walk.
So the purpose of being on horseback is simply to cover more ground?
You can cover more ground, yeah. And actually, the important thing in the field trial game is that we are trying to develop and improve the breed. So for people that hunt on foot, you ideally want to go towards a field trial dog. Those are the dogs with the most drive, the most stamina. We're proving that these dogs are the elite. So you want to go to the elite for your breeding purposes or for your puppies because if you just breed mediocre dogs or just foot hunting dogs and work close, you're just going to get closer and closer.
Well, that brings me to something else. I understand you have quite a few dogs of your own and you breed dogs.
Yes.
And you also mentor people and help them raise their dogs, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'm very much invested in the dogs that I breed and the puppies I produce. And there's a lot of important things. It's a lot of work, so I don't do a lot of litters. I've done 3. So I do a few breedings, and then I have some new people to field trialing that I've sold puppies to, and I'm very excited to see them compete. And then the nice thing is everyone in the field trial game, it might be competitive, but everyone wants to see a good dog run.
That was Laura Miller, a trainer of hunting dogs or gun dogs. You're listening to Local Talk on KJOI Community Radio.
It's interesting, Kay. Iowa has a lot of hunters and perhaps enough game birds to interest them in hunting, but not a lot of what you would call wild space.
Yeah, we have a lot of open space, I suppose, if you count cornfields. But as our next guest, Mark Edwards, points out, the landscape has been drastically altered so that only small parts still exist in the form that they once did.
Mark Edwards has been on our station before. He is a writer who used to work for the Department of Natural Resources in the Trails Management Division. A couple of decades in this field gave him plenty of opportunity to develop a philosophy of our place here in Iowa.
I sat down with Mark the other day to discuss a variety of related issues, including this notion of biophilia, the inbred love of nature, or a sense of calm in nature that humans feel, even as our culture as a whole seems to be growing away from nature.
The conversation, as I recall, starts out with the state park system in Iowa, where we were back in the beginning and where we are now.
The state parks in Iowa, I had the impression that, you know, there were plenty of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I was reading in something you'd written that if you joined all the state parks together, they take up less area than the city of Des Moines.
Yes, that's about correct. We're around 50,000 acres, somewhere in there, and it's stayed pretty stable over all the years. In 1937, Iowa led the nation in the establishment of state parks. And so Now we rank pretty much at the very bottom nationally. In various categories, you can do it by population or you can do it by size. And mm-hmm. either one, we're right down there okay. towards the bottom.
We can. But for a while, we were the leading state yes. in establishing them.
Yeah, and I think we were I'm really excited by looking back into history and trying to understand these changes. It was because we had changed the landscape of Iowa so fast. I mean, we'd converted that prairie system over into farming, agricultural uses, and just a rate unheard of. And in that process, I think people begin to really quickly realize how important these remaining areas that weren't completely altered. For example, every state park actually has been logged at least once or more. And so when we look at our state parks, you know, we're already talking about a landscape that's been altered. But we did want to set aside these areas. And so, you know, they were very critical to us. We set a national precedent working with the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, in the 1930s. And we put them to work doing a lot of trail work, a lot of stabilization of these highly eroding ravines that were coming down off this farmland above and things like that. So there was a tradition, a real caring for our parks and everything. And then for some reason that has just not really changed much over the years. We've not added much to it, and yet the numbers of people using those areas continues to increase.
Right,
and we keep
right.
expanding, you know,
campgrounds. Yeah, and as they continue to increase, they, I suppose, need more facilities, maybe more campgrounds and things, which takes
right.
takes up the space for the park.
Yeah, and I've tried to figure out different ways to explain and give some visual way of understanding, you know, is the change that's happened in Iowa. And one of the ways was because I started with parks, I realized that, you know, you really put all the state parks together in the state reserves, you've got a square like 9 miles on a side. And I don't think, you know, we realize you compare it to the city of Des Moines, and I kept looking at it in terms of trails, and I did an inventory of all the trails in the state parks, the official trails, and those came up to just about the same amount of street miles in the city of Des Moines. So
wow.
we have about the same concentration. And so these vast areas that seem so big when you first go into them actually become very small after you spend time in there. And I was lucky to spend time in most of those state parks doing work. And so you realize that you can walk across those parks in about an hour. It's just,
which isn't a very long hike at all.
No, it's not a very long hike. And what makes the ledges nice is you have some change in elevation. So
right.
you're going up and down steep and it adds something to it. But it's really not that big of a park and none of ours really are. I mean, you can practically see to the other trail. I mean, even though it's hidden somewhat in the green leaves, we still have a spaghetti work of trails in those
mm-hmm.
parks that are pretty close together, actually.
And you say they've all been logged, even Ledges State Park?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I have pictures of Ledges State Park with hardly a tree in there. There are some of the oldest trees in the state are still in there in the bottom of the ravines where they just quickly couldn't get down into those trees. So we do have some old specimens left in those things. But the vast majority, if you're down in the canyon and you look up on those sides, there's pictures of hardly a tree anywhere up there. It's highly grazed, sheep, cattle. There was a lot of mining going on in the park, a lot of
Yeah, Iowa used to be the largest mining state at one time.
We still a lot of gravel. I mean, different things. So if you look at what we're learning through the science of conservation biology and you look at what we're learning through the ecology understanding of where we live and how we live and how our needs are met, you see that all our needs are met by that landscape. And so the basic tenets of ecology or conservation biology is the health of the individual is met by the health of the system that individual is in. So the higher the diversity, the more healthy the ecosystem is. You know, it's like dominoes. You start taking pieces out, and at one point, the whole system will fall apart. And I think we're seeing that now in various ways. We're talking about climate change, but to me, I think it's even more important to look at the loss of species. We haven't seen the loss of species like this rate that we're in now for 65 million years. I don't think it's possible for us to comprehend what that means, but we're seeing it as the pollinators, the bees and things are dying off at a rate unheard of. And our plants, our food system depends on those pollinators. So there's all these connections and dots that need connected that we need to understand more holistically the system that we're living in, because you can't keep taking parts out and reduce it down to a one and two species, in effect, think that you're going to eat and live on those one or two species.
Right. And of course, we're realizing more and more that people need, for their mental as well as their physical health, they need wild spaces.
That's correct. And there's a wonderful book out, Last Child Left in the Woods,
right.
And Nature Deficit Disorder. And we're quickly realizing that we need those things. And actually, I was reading an article this morning that I'd stumbled onto about our sad, we're not getting enough light and all these kinds of anxiety and stuff. And we look at drugs like Prozac to answer that. But actually, the very thing that raises our serotonin level, which increases our happiness, is found in soil and healthy soil. And so I think that explains to me why I just love gardening. I love getting into the dirt. And as kids, rolling in the dirt, it's all that level of interacting with that other world there that keeps you happy, keeps you healthy.
Yeah, and they discovered that letting kids play in the dirt helps prevent allergies and so on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was widowed when I was in my 30s. And I discovered that I couldn't stand to go into the city. It was as if, okay, I can cope with this grief and so on as long as I'm in natural surroundings. But the grief combined with living in the city was more than I could. So I just avoided, whenever I could, going into the city, which was an eye-opener to me because I didn't think I cared that much about nature, but it was just a gut reaction. I couldn't cope with both at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a perfect example. And I think I've met lots of people who had that story. My story is the same. I was raised in the Air Force. We lived in all these gigantic big cities, Tokyo, and came back from Tokyo back into Iowa and started spending time outside. And from that point on, I remember I graduated from Iowa State and moved into a cabin over to the river for the summer, and it didn't have electricity or running water. And 17 years later, I'm still there. I'd put in electricity. But I was very happy. I mean, it was the healthiest, happiest I can imagine being in my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I feel the same way. And I think kids especially, if you turn a kid outside and he feels safe and everything, my gosh, he's just the freedom that comes out of that child is just – you can see it. And so I picked ticks because people have a tremendous fear of ticks now because of the Lyme disease or for whatever reason, which is too bad because they're a generalist. They're a species that's moving in because of the disturbances we've made. So we're like creating our own fears or becoming real because of the things, the way we interact with the place we live. That's my really fascination is, what is this relationship between people and place? Where do we find happiness? Where do we find feeling good and safe and protected? Those are basic human questions that we should be asking.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the world is going, it feels unsafe more and more. And all we hear is all the negative about the, environment problems and crashing and climate change and all this. But if you get out there and you interact with it directly, personally, it's very rewarding, very refreshing.
Right. Now, ticks, you've said, are an indicator species, though the multiplication of ticks, the proliferation of ticks, indicates a disturbed environment. So ticks are an indicator species that show disturbance.
Yes, there's been some really good studies done of late documenting this, and there's been various studies over the years showing this. And it's true of, we think of invasive species also. So ticks were a good example to me because we're seeing them more and more in Iowa. The Lyme disease rate is going up. If I go into an habitat that was disturbed rather recently, the tick numbers are a lot higher than if I go into an older growth state park. So I found less ticks in some state parks, and I would go to new recreation areas that, say, used to be farmed and have now been let go, the tick numbers were just tremendous compared. As ticks become a higher number, now we're seeing the disease and the pathogens and stuff coming with them and altering to the altered landscape also. So these things mutate. That's what we're not quite sure where this is going to go into the future. And a good example is what's going on with the chickens and turkeys in Iowa now.
What would be another example of an indicator species in addition to ticks?
Well, an indicator species is indicating what? So ticks, are one sense of indicating a disturbed habitat. But we could look at other species as indicator species of not disturbed habitats. So the things that used to be here are not here now. And so one example would be the monarch butterfly. you know, in 20 years, it's dropped 80%, and it kind of correlates to our use of Roundup and on the landscape. And so now we're looking at they're being declared as an endangered species.
But it's also to do with partly what these species eat, isn't it?
Well, sure. That's right. And again, that relationship to the milkweed, which is their main source of food, and egg laying and everything, is the one that was Roundup has killed out. We've essentially eliminated a fairly common plant here in Iowa, too hard to find, enough that the butterfly can't continue to get enough to eat or to even migrate across the state.
Right, so, and there's some ducks that can't.
Yeah, the lesser scaup duck, the most common diving duck in North America, has also failed the same fate. The water quality in Iowa is so bad that it can't find enough to eat in the water to even migrate across the state. Another good example, like we could say, you know, we're losing all the prairie songbirds, but we're getting house sparrows and crows.
I'm from London originally, and there's so many sparrows. I mean, they're one bird that can stand living in the city, along
yes.
with pigeons, I guess.
Yes. And then they become a trouble. I mean, in here in Ames, we have trouble with the crows. The numbers, we're trying to scare them away from Main Street. They can survive here very easily, and they prefer the warm habitat in the winter. You know, I go back and I try to look on a scale that gives some definition. So I picked the state of Iowa, and you have 36 million acres here, and you have two-thirds of this state is covered in only two species, corn and beans. And then we spray, we do all this. It's an annual. It's only up a certain percent of the year. Not much really lives on those two species alone. But what is a species that has been thriving because of it is deer. So we have an explosion of deer population, but we have a loss of birds and a loss of milkweeds and a loss of butterflies and a loss of lightning bugs. And we bring in all these plants to plant in our yard, and we don't want them to have a problem. But that all that says is there's a problem because nothing will eat them. You know, there's no relationship
exactly.
to everything else
yes.
that's there. So you want insects to be living on those plants.
Butterflies are a good example because before you get butterflies, you've got to have caterpillars.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's interesting the way they've done that at Ryman Gardens. There's nothing there that caterpillars eat.
Yes.
Within the the display area, we see the butterflies, and they sort of raise the butterflies elsewhere.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
We need to look at it starkly and straight in the face. You can't live with two species covering your landscape. So we have to start looking at some alternatives, and to me, that's where things get exciting. That's where things really open up. You know, the other thing that motivates people is fear, and I'm getting older, I don't want to be fearful anymore. I want to move forward and think about a world that I want to live in instead of just
Well, how do we help bring that world about, though?
Okay. I think one of the popular movements that I've been seeing is like a citizen science where there's actually a good website, inaturalist.org, and it's talking about where people actually go out and start tracking what they do see. And then with the technology and computers, you can start throwing that all out and getting it on a site and looking it up and seeing where people are seeing rare things. And so you start kind of tracking. That's what people have done with butterflies. That's how we've learned what's going on with the butterfly. And so it gets you back in tune with what you're seeing outside in your real world. And then interacting and then tracking it so you have some kind of relationship with that.
Right.
And that's what it's all about, is having some kind of relationship. I think the other flip side of this, that's down on the day-to-day ground level. On the other level is, you know, we need a vision for where we're going to go into the future.
Right.
And the vision for me has been captured very well by what's called the Wildlands Project or the Wildlands Network. And what that did is it realized that as this species crash, which we haven't seen in 65 million years, that's how fast things are deteriorating. How do you provide some kind of future for these species to continue? And so we, in the past, we had this thing with state parks, and we set up national parks, and we've set up all these areas to try to, and even Yellowstone, one of our largest national parks, cannot maintain biological diversity now. It is having terrible problems also. So we're looking at, what's the vision? The vision is you have to grab the core pieces that are left because we've actually developed, 98% of it in Iowa. So you grab these last little remnants that are left and you
Which
do everything.
Like the state parks.
State parks is the perfect example. And then you do everything to protect them. You quit developing inside those, which is what we're still developing in our state parks. So we're still reducing the natural habitat within these state parks, more campgrounds, more roads. I could go on and on and on.
It's a paradox because on the one hand, we want people to appreciate this. We want them to want to go to the national parks.
Right.
And this is why it's so difficult to know what to do. And you're mentioning that Yellowstone, for example, can't maintain its diversity of species and that we need to have corridors linking these parks.
Yes. And actually, you know, back to that scale, landscape looking scale, you know, Iowa is so devastated in terms of its biological diversity. Its role in the future will be connecting Minnesota and Missouri. So we need to start looking at a trail, you know, maybe miles wide that runs up and down this last little river courses that are left, connecting some of this habitat.
And this is so that the species can migrate.
And the flow of biological diversity. And if global climate change is continuing to go at the change, it's at the rate it's going now, those some of the species which can move at least will have a way to start moving north to adjust to these temperatures.
Forget about climate change for a minute. Okay. Some of them need to maintain, you know, they don't get too inbred.
Exactly.
They need to migrate to breed and so on.
That's right. So every state park, if you look at, you know, the 64 state parks in the state, they're all separated. They're right. Islands of which hardly any interaction is taking place between the things in that park. That's why they're losing diversity and they're continuing to go downhill. Every one of them is degrading over time.
Can ordinary people do anything to bring this about, these corridors and so on?
Sure. There's a thing in front of the legislatures right now to fund any kind of conservation in Iowa, and I think we're going downhill. We're spending less every year on conservation. I think we need to go the other way.
Okay.
So I would say call your legislators right now.
And that was Mark Edwards, retired Parks and Trails Specialist for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, speaking with my co-host, Kay Puttock, about our state parks system and other topics.
And now we move from state parks to municipal parks with Ames Parks and Rec Director Keith Abraham. Welcome, Keith.
Good morning.
Actually, we've planned to talk more about the rec part of his job today. Summer and outdoor recreation is just around the corner, but many of us in Ames keep fit during the colder months by swimming at the indoor pool. This pool over at the Ames High School, and in fact shared with the school district, is reaching the end of its life. And as such, the city and school district have reached a crossroads. Do they part ways and each build a separate pool? Do they share a new pool? These questions have big price tags and have big implications for swimmers. And Keith is here to explain the issues and invite our Ames area listeners to help sort through them at special public input meetings. So, Keith, should we start with the timeline? How long will the existing pool function?
So just maybe just to give a little bit of history, municipal pool was built in 1965, so it just had its 50th birthday. And some things that people don't know is that the facility itself is owned by the City of Ames. It's on school district property. In the school district and the City of Ames, we actually share operational and capital expenses 50-50. So it has been a good arrangement. You know, right now, as far as the life of the pool, we have had studies done over the years, and they had their findings that pretty much said that, hey, when you get to about this time, you know, 2015, 2017, there's not going to be much life left. There was a series of recommendations that they gave us that we needed to look at and do. And between the school district and us, we have taken care of some of the major issues. We've replaced the boilers. We had a situation with the input piping, you know, to the pool. And that was really our major concern. We did that two summers ago. So really right now we feel that we'll probably get, a few years out of it, but there may be something that, you know, we just don't know that at any time something could go wrong. That's why we're looking at, you know, the possibility of a new aquatic center.
Okay, and what are the different interests involved in this? We've got competitive swimmers, and explain how this has come. Who have you been hearing from so far?
Right. Well, and with our conversations with the school district, you know, their needs are obviously competitive swimming for the swim team, and they've had a lot of success, you know, with their swim team and with their diving team. So competitive swimming is their main focus. And with that, they've been kind of going back and forth with, do we do a 50-meter pool? Do we do a 25-yard pool? And the pool up there right now is 25 yards. So competitive swimming on one side, and not only for their program, but also the Ames Cyclone Aquatics Club. You know, they are a competitive swimming group that we work with, but use that facility. So competitive swimming is their avenue. They're also a group out there of master swimmers, you know, that would love to have time, not necessarily competitive swimming, but some of them are. But they need a facility kind of more of along the lines of a competitive pool. So that's the one side of it. The other side of it is from the recreation side is from a swim lesson standpoint. And one of the issues, too, that we have, I'll maybe speak to that in a little bit, is the water temperature. So we have from the recreation side, we want people to learn how to swim. Swimming is a lifelong sport. It's an activity that you can enjoy for many, many years. But when you have deeper water, it's not really conducive for swimming lessons. But there is also with the Furman Aquatic Center, with the success that we've had there, water walkers, it's a different, you know, exercise opportunity. There's a lot of people that have said, hey, you know, could we, if we're going to build a new facility, can we incorporate some water walking or have, you know, something like that? Tot time, the splash pool that we have at Furman Aquatic Center, which is a zero depth. It's easy for all ages to get in, not only kids. That's what a lot of people think about. But the elderly, if the water is a little warmer, the elderly can get into that pool very easily also. And if it is, you know, 4 foot deep in the deepest part of it, you know, that gives the elderly an opportunity to get in the water easily, but then also use that for exercise.
By zero depth, you mean it just gradually goes down?
Correct.
From
correct.
Walking level.
Yep. It's so you just walk in, and then the water gets deeper as you go in. That's been very popular. There's some requests for slides. Now, one of the things with slides that people are doing with indoor aquatic centers is the whole slide does not have to be housed inside. You know, you can walk up a set of stairs, get to the top, and then the slide actually goes outside, you know, does its twirls, and then, you know, comes back into the facility, which it saves money because you don't have to build, you know, the building to encompass all of that. So those are the two issues. We have the competitive side. We have the recreational side. And that's what we're hearing.
And presumably the children and the folks who – the elderly who might just be doing walking –
aqua aerobics.
They would like the temperature to be a little warmer.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. Right now, competitive swimmers generally like the water about 78 degrees, and recreational swimming for swim lessons and so on, probably more like for indoor aquatic center, more in the neighborhood of about 86, 87. So a little warmer temperature. And then you can even get to if there's sometimes with therapy situations where they might even want the water a little bit warmer. So you can't do that all in one basin. Right now at Municipal Pool, we've reached a compromise where we keep the water temperature at 83. So which is a little warmer than the competitive swimmers want it, and it's a little cooler than what the recreational swimmers want it. And it's interesting that, you know, even with our swim lessons, you can tell the difference pretty much. Excuse me, our instructors, you know, they know the difference pretty well just by how the kids behave, you know, once they get in there. So it gets down to 82, sometimes 81, and, you know, there's a big difference. And it's not conducive to teaching somebody when they're so worried about being cold.
So it sounds like we're heading toward a two-pool situation, but what would be the cost of that? Could the city afford that?
Yeah, and right now that is one option. There's several options, you know, that are out there in regards to what happens. And right now, at the beginning, it did seem like the school district was kind of going for a competitive pool, maybe 50-meter situation. We're kind of going down a path for an aquatic center that really deals more with the recreational needs. But within the last couple months, we've sat down with the school district. We're both kind of at this situation where, hey, where do we go from here? And that's why we're doing the public education and input sessions. So several options that are out there is, one, it could be a joint facility. It could have the competitive basin. It could have some recreational components. They could be housed in the same facility, and we do something similar. But we have agreed that if we do another joint facility, that, you know, some things would need to change in regards to operations and things to make it more efficient and stuff. So with that, so that's one option, is you have all these basins under one roof. A second option is that you have a competitive facility and you have a recreational facility, and they're side by side with a common entry area, and the school district operates their side. You know, we operate our side, but yet there is going to be an opportunity for sharing. If there's a swim meet going on, you know, a lot of siblings come to these swim meets. It could be an opportunity to be part. Those kids could be participating there. You know, there are some times when we are going to also need, you know, potentially deeper water. And then the last option would be just two separate facilities, whether they're on the same site or potentially on different sites. So right now we don't know, you know, Greta, which way, you know, we're going. That's why we're having these public input sessions. We really want to hear from the community. What do you want us? Give us some ideas. What do you want housed in these facilities? What kinds of activities do you want to do? Based on those activities, then we'll be able to determine what amenities we need to put in these facilities. And then obviously then there's also the price tag. Right now it's kind of premature to say, hey, how much is it going to cost with it? If we were to do just a recreational indoor aquatic center, which maybe have some lap lanes, a zero depth entry, a slide or two, something along those lines, you know, we could be talking anywhere in the neighborhood of $7 to $9 million, depending on what it is. And I'm not really sure, I don't want to misspeak, but I'm going to guess on the competitive side, it's going to be very similar or even more. So because with a competitive pool, generally there's seating that needs to be made available, and that takes up a lot. That's a big footprint. You know, you can put storage and things underneath the seating, but it makes your building larger, and that it adds to the cost.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to get to the public input sessions in a moment, but speaking of input, footprint, is all of this going to fit at the site where the pool now is, by the Ames High School, or is that too small to accommodate a joint pool, say, if that mm-hmm. was going to be the solution?
Yeah. If you're looking at right exactly where a municipal pool is, it most likely will be larger than that. But one of the things that you have to look at also is municipal pool is still going to have to be operational while these other facilities are being built. Because if you took the pool away and tried to build, you'd go with potentially a year or two of no swimming opportunities in the wintertime, any indoor opportunities. So there have been, the school district has graciously offered that, hey, the city can put a facility on school district property. Now, another thing, and this would be a question for the school district, but they are looking into the future potentially with a new high school. So that's one of the things where, hey, where does this pool go? So if you're familiar with the area, there is the football practice field, the soccer practice field. There's the softball diamond up there, the tennis courts. With the 24th Street site, they are moving some of not necessarily the practice field, but the softball, their baseball is going to be going up to 24th Street. So that is going to open up some of that area. So there have been, without actually pointing to a map or anything, there are a couple of different options of where potentially these facilities or this one facility could be placed up there at the high school.
Well, that's a lot to throw into the mix, into your decision making. So I can see why you want to do this very carefully. Can you tell us about the public input sessions?
Yeah. So with the we're going to be holding three, and we're calling them education and input sessions, because there is some misinformation just talking to people, listening to people, reading what people are saying. There's some misinformation. So the first part of the meeting, what we really want to do is we want to educate the public. School district will be there as well. And we really want to share, hey, here's where we're at right now. So some of the information that we've just discussed will be shared at the beginning. And then at the end, we're really going to be spending time on asking the public, the attendees there, to share your thoughts. Give us your feelings. What do you want to see? How do you want to use this? And it's not only from the current users. We really want to encourage people that, hey, I do not use the current municipal pool, but if a new facility was built, if you had this in it, you know, we would come and use it. We would participate. So that's something we really want to get people, even if you're not currently using it, but if you would, or if there would be something in there that would entice you to use it, we want you to come out and give us that input. In addition to those sessions, we're also going to be holding some focus groups with, you know, different groups. We're going to be talking to the hotel motel in Ames, business leaders, Ames Cyclone Aquatics Club, swim lesson parents, lap swimmers. So we're going to have focus groups just more so, you know, a specific demographic and try to get feedback from them as well.
Well, that's great. I know you have a meeting to go to.
Yes.
So we'll say thank you and say goodbye now.
Well, thank you, Greta, and that time went very fast.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. And here's Belinda Merritt with an update on music.
Hello, this is Belinda Merritt, and I have the live music for May 22nd through the 28th. On Friday, May 22nd, J. Clyde Band will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler Street. Danny Grouse will be at West Town Pub, 4518 Mortensen Road. Liana, Crystal City, and Fetal Pig will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. Elegant Gypsy will be at Snooze Hill Winery, 2183 320th Street, Madrid, from 6:30 until 9:30 p.m. On Saturday, May 23rd, the Indigo Monks with Paul Hertz will be at Blue Stem, which was formerly Zeke's, 3329 Lincoln Way, from 8 until 11 p.m. All ages are welcome, and tickets are available at eventbrite.com. Work release will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. On Sunday, May 24th, Be Bad and A Case of the Blues will be at Snooze Hill Winery, 2183 320th Street, Madrid, from 2 until 5 p.m. On Thursday, May 28th, Eichner, Mastiff, and Underdog Story will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. That's all I have for this week. Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We started off the hour with wildlife correspondent Pat Schlarbaum on the topic of peregrine falcons.
Then we heard my interviews with Laura Miller, trainer of national champion gun dogs, and Mark Edwards, a retired state parks and trails specialist with the DNR.
Finally, we talked with Keith Abraham about plans for a new swimming pool or swimming pools in Ames. And for those of you who are interested in attending those input sessions, they are May 28th at 6:30, June 1st at 6:30, and June 4th at 9 a.m. And all of those meetings are at Ames Public Library.
Dates and times of public input sessions at the swimming pool, as well as links to our guests' contact information, will be available on our website later in the day. That's at khoifm.org. when you can also listen to a podcast of the show.
We've been your hosts, Kay Puttock and Greta Anderson. Our engineer was Becca Brown. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join our team, contact us by phone at 292-2878 or come by our studio on 410 Douglas Avenue to find out what community radio is all about.
As always, your participation as audience and your generous donations are what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.